Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. Happy New Year to you all. We get to say that at least till Saturday as far as I'm concerned. I'm Allison Stewart. This is the top of our first show of 2019. And we have two questions. What happened while we were away? And what do you hope happens in 2019? For the first part, in a moment, we're going to check in with some friends from The Gothamist. As for the second question, we want to check in with y'all. Did you make resolutions? A recent poll conducted by NPR, PBS, and Marist showed that 44% of American adults intended to make a resolution for 2019. We want to hear yours. Tweet us at All of It WNYC, or you can always call us 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Did you make a resolution? And also, the elephant in the room, did you already break the resolution in 24 hours? We promised. No judgments. 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. Now to what happened in the last days of 2018. Well, we all saw that Louis C.K. tried comedy. Bird Box took off on Netflix. But what happened locally last week while we were all in transit or in Christmas cookie comas? I'm joined now in studio by my colleagues from The Gothamist, Jen Chung. Hi, Jen.
Hi.
And Claire Lampin. Hi, Claire.
Hi.
They're going to run down some cultural stories that occurred while we were all hanging out. Nice to see you guys, by the way.
Good to see you, and Happy New Year.
Thanks. Did you make resolutions?
I did, and I brought my lunch today, so
check that off. Great. Good for you. How about you, Claire? Did you make a resolution?
I didn't. Not this year.
Okay. Well, maybe by the end of this segment. Mine was to speak more slowly on the radio, but that hasn't happened yet, so we'll work on it. So tell me about, Jen, New Year's Eve. I mean, there were a lot of different things went on New Year's Eve, a lot of surprise things.
Yeah, I mean, New York City is the place everyone wants to be. And I think for a lot of New Yorkers, people who live here, they go out to their favorite restaurants or bars or meet up with their friends at their homes. But there are thousands of tourists, maybe even a million people that come to New York City to experience Times Square for that moment when the ball drops. And they are waiting out in these pens, like beginning at 8 a.m. on December 31st. And as someone who has always loved New York City, I grew up in New Jersey, I always
wanted,
I mean, I always wanted to live here and work here, and I'm lucky enough to do that. But these are people who have dreamed about New York City and have this other passion for it that's very different from ours as people who are residents. And I have this like deep admiration for them. I mean, I know people think they're crazy. Why would they come to New York Times Square of all places? You can't leave. There are no bathrooms. Like, what are they doing? But these are people who have this strong connection to want to like be here and be around so many people and see what all the fuss is about, see the big buildings. They're going to go see the tree after. They already went to the museums. People go to the Statue of Liberty. I know a lot of New Yorkers who have never been there. So I spoke to them. They've been planning these trips for like a year, and they stood there in the rain waving their balloons.
Because it was rainy. It was such a tough night.
It was like
night.
Pouring at yeah. certain points. And they, you know, rang in the new year and just part of that huge celebration there. And it is amazing. I actually recommend people to at least be in the vicinity at least once, because I've been going to a lot of the press conferences. They actually test the confetti 2 days before to make sure gravity works. And that's a nice sort of like way, easy way in. It's like a little hack a few days before. And then you just see all these, there's so much preparation, and it's really incredible, this huge show that goes on for the world.
And when, you know, I'm in my previous life, I was live in Times Square 4 times for NBC and had to, you know, do it the whole thing. And people, people come and propose. We had somebody propose on the air once. And the other thing that's sort of fun is, did you notice all the networks have stages? So there's Ryan Seacrest on one stage, and then there's Anderson Cooper and Andy Cohen on the next stage. And they're only, like, you know, 20 feet apart. There's a spectacle happening, not just the spectacle of Times Square, but also the making of the TV and of the media of Times Square.
Yeah, I mean, there was this one man that we spoke to. He drove 27 hours from Mexico to come to Times Square. So while we were there, we spoke to his sister, and he was, like, sleeping.
Hey, we got a call. Somebody wants to share with us their resolution. I believe this is Christopher from Astoria. Hi, Christopher.
Hi, nice to speak to you. Happy New Year to you.
Same to you. So what have you resolved to do?
So my resolution for this year is to just take care of what I need to take care of immediately. There's nothing specific, but like, for example, like last night I wanted to mend a hole in my sweater, and I would have let it go until maybe June of the year without taking care of it. But instead I went on YouTube, I learned how to sew, I got some thread and needle together, and I fixed my hole within like an hour. So just little things like that where you just don't let it wait and just take care of it, and because it's always easier than you think it's going to be.
That is a great one. Christopher, thanks for
sharing.
That's
my resolution.
And
Thank you.
Good job, man.
That's
good
inspiring.
Job. If you want to call in, we're at 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. Share your resolution. Maybe share a resolution you already broke. Said no judgments, 212-433-WNYC. So Stonewall had a special surprise guest.
Right, so the exact opposite of being in Times Square. The Stonewall Inn, which is very famous for its part of gay rights history, they have an intimate New Year's Eve celebration, and at one point there's Madonna, who decides to surprise the crowd with a message talking about Stonewall's importance. She was named the Stonewall Ambassador the other week because it's going to be the 50th anniversary this year of the riots, and she sang two songs, Can't Help Falling in Love and Like a Prayer. And there was a sing-along, of course.
Of course.
So, I mean, I can't imagine the energy being there.
That must have been amazing.
I mean,
it would have been a great room to be in.
I don't know. Would 2019 then be all downhill from that point?
or it's a catalyst. It's a way to get things going. So, Claire.
Yes.
The polar bear plunge. Do you know about the polar bear plunge? This where people go in the water.
I know about it. I was not actually there.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, I think yesterday with the great weather, it was 57 degrees, and mm-hmm. it might have encouraged some more people who wanted to maybe check this off of their bucket list to go out into the still freezing waters off of Coney Island.
Sorry, I didn't mean to stump you. You, Claire, you can tell me what to do with my Christmas tree.
Yes. So very, very exciting. Mulch Fest is upon us. So that's technically from January 4th to January 14th, but if you do not want to drag your tree to one of the 68 mulching sites located throughout the city, then you can put it out on the curb starting today. Sanitation department will come and take it away for mulching. But on the weekend of January 12th to January 13th, if you want to bring it to a mulching site to have it chipped, you can do that between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m., and they will give you a free bag of mulch.
Do I have to make sure there's my tree is clean, I guess?
Oh, yeah.
Tinsel free, etc.
Yeah, take off. So they're only accepting naked trees, so you have to take off the stand, definitely, and tinsel, ornaments, lights, all of it. It's all got to go.
All right, as we continue to look forward, I'm not going to say I necessarily look forward to the no pants subway ride, but it happens every year.
It has become a tradition unto its own.
Yeah, I think it's fun. So that's coming up on January 13th, which is a Sunday, and
been warned, everybody.
It'll be roughly between 3 and 5 p.m. is what I think so far, but more information will be available the week before. So if you're interested in participating, you can keep an eye on their social media accounts. But they will release like a list of predetermined meeting locations. You will convene by yourself or with a group, bring a backpack, and get ready to stash your pants in it.
Stash your pants. Didn't think I'd hear that on the radio show. Hey, we got a tweet. Lauren tweeted us about her New Year's resolution. I resolved to keep doing what I'm doing and make no grand resolutions so I don't have to feel guilty when I ultimately fail to keep them. I'm pretty sure this is going to be the first year I keep my resolution. That is a wily human being. Lauren, thank you so much for tweeting. Let's go to Jim in Long Island. Jim is on line one. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing great. What's your resolution, Jim?
First of all, Happy New Year.
Yeah, thank you, too.
My resolution is to pare down. I lost my parents a few years ago, and it was my job to empty their house, and my dad was a hoarder. I mean, he collected everything. We had stuff in the 20s and 30s and 40s, whatever. It took me a year and a half to really empty his house. And I don't want that to happen here. I looked at my stuff and I said, I've got too much. time for me to pare down old clothes, pare down things I don't use anymore, and just basically make it so that the house is livable and don't have so much stuff. Don't need that much stuff.
Jim, you're talking to the right person, because I wrote an entire book about this because I had to clean out my parents' house. And we're actually going to have someone who was an expert in my book on Friday. On Friday's show, Jim, you have to listen. This wonderful woman named Linda Samuels, who deals with a lot of families who have to clean up and clean out. My one piece of advice I give everybody is, if you really are having a hard time, don't touch the stuff. Have someone else touch it. Because, and hold it up for you and say, do you want to keep this? Because there's just all this science about haptic. Once you touch something, a certain amount of the population immediately takes some ownership. So that's my tip for you, Jim. And also listen on Friday, because we're going to talk all about this. Let's go to Mickey in Manhattan on line 4. Hi, Mickey.
Yes, hi. How are you all? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. What's your resolution?
My New Year's resolution is actually to go out more with my friends. I normally don't, you know, kind of like to go out. It's a lot of hassle, you know, to like go to the bar and get drinks or whatever. But actually last night, two nights ago for New Year's Eve, I went out for the first time ever in my 24 years of living. I'm coming from a very traditional Japanese family where we kind of like spend New Year's Eve together. We eat soba and everything, and so this is really the first time that I did that. And I, you know, we went to a bar in Brooklyn, and I just had like a lot of fun. And normally, when I'm making these decisions for whether to go out or not, it's usually like, you know, I'm kind of on the fence about it. But this time, I really tipped the scale, and I chose to go out. And I had actually had a lot of fun, and made a lot of really good memories with my friends. And so, kind of that's what I'm trying to. And go for this year is to, if I'm really kind of feeling like on the fence about whether to stay in or go out, is to just kind of like take that jump and go out.
Mickey, you made everybody in the studio smile. We're all nodding our heads and saying, yay, Mickey, good for you. Thank you so much for calling in. It's interesting because you started the segment, Jen, talking about people who decided to just make the trek and go to Times Square and to go out. Did you get a sense of, I mean, aside from the bucket list of it, the sense of community about why they wanted to be there?
I think, you know, there are movies about it. They see, you know, TV broadcasts of it each year. And they actually do develop these little communities. You know, you're waiting there for hours. Mm-hmm. So you meet like this one family from Georgia, met this family from Florida, and they became buddies during the day. And, you know, some people are playing games. I also saw a Domino's pizza guy selling a plain pie for $25 a piece because they are captive there. So, you know, it's interesting, like new communities developing in, you know, each block of Times Square.
And it's also interesting the idea that people are making a memory. Like Mickey said, she said, I have a good memory of this New Year's Eve now. It's so great.
Right. I mean, this father who'd been planning the trip with his daughters for the past year, I mean, that's something that they were really excited about, that they could spend this time together. And I can only imagine spending 14 hours with your dad in a pen, you know.
When you put it that way.
Right.
Our number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. Would you like to share your New Year's resolution? We would love to hear from you what you think you, what you've planned for the next year. Okay, so other things that are coming up in the future. I have lived here 30 years, and I have never heard of the Iditarod. Is that right? Am I saying it? It's like the Iditarod, but for idiots?
Yes, correct.
Okay. You have to explain that, because that sentence made no sense.
Yeah, so this will be the 15th annual Iditarod, and it's coming up on January 26th, 2019, so that gives you plenty of time to start working on your costumes and your decorated shopping cart. And every year, the costumes and the carts are really, really elaborate, so it's probably best to get that together now. But basically the premise is that you get a team together, you dress up, and you make this like crazy shopping cart float. And you go from checkpoint to checkpoint, usually in Brooklyn, but like ride your way through New York to each of these checkpoints where you drink and you're judged. And yeah, bribes are encouraged if you if you're feeling very competitive. But at the end, there's a big party and everyone destroys the carts. So I guess it's sort of like the bike kill for shopping carts, maybe.
Wow. Somebody wants to know if you, how do you get a shopping cart? Do you borrow one? from someplace? Or I'm not saying you should.
You're going to destroy it.
Okay, so you won't be giving it back is what you're telling us. All right, let's talk to Cynthia from Sunset Park. She's online too. Hi, Cynthia.
Hey.
Hi. Happy New Year.
Thanks. Same to you. So I have two parts. The first one is I'm going to stop reading my phone in bed.
Ooh.
And I'm one for one on that.
Yay. So. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thanks. And then the other is I don't want to make my resolutions quite yet because the pressure is too great and the chance of, you know, dropping out too soon. So I'm going to wait a week or two and kind of think them through and try to make them work.
What made you what led you to the phone resolution?
And what are your tips?
It's definitely become too much of a habit. And I think it's actually unfair to my husband for him to see this like glow in my face as I'm holding this little phone. So, you know, I just think that's wrong. You know, it's not good. And I see that it's become too much. And my tip, I think I actually got this from a friend of mine, is just keep it in another room, far away. It seems so obvious, but that's what I did.
That's a great one.
I left it plugged in far away. Well,
there you go. Because once you're, especially in the winter, once you're all cuddled in underneath your comforter, you're not getting out of bed.
Yeah.
Get the phone.
Right, exactly.
Cynthia, thank you so much. And Jen, there's a big event at Lincoln Center. This sounds amazing.
So the director, Alfonso Cuarón, his new film, Roma, is getting all these amazing accolades. And it is on Netflix, but it's also in a few theaters. But they're actually going to have the 70mm presentation of it. And people who have seen it have been like, you need to see it on the big screen.
Oh, I bet. It is so gorgeous.
So that is at Lincoln Center at the Film Society on January 4th, so in 2 days. But they're also showing some of his other films, including The Little Princess, Children of Men, Great Expectations, Gravity. So if you want to catch up on all of his other works, seeing it on the big screen is really special.
Wow, that's a great thing to do to kick off going, hey, Mickey, if you heard that, that's something you can go do. Let's go to Needy. Needy is calling us from Short Hills, New Jersey. Hi, Needy.
Hi, how are you? Happy New Year.
Oh, same to you. What's your resolution?
Well, I have a bunch of them, but I'll rattle off my first three. The first is to maintain a paper scheduler, as in write all my chores for the day, literally write them down and scratch them by the end of the day when I've finished. Number two is to do more sprouting. I want to eat more sprouted foods, so I will hopefully do more sprouting at home. And number three is to keep more in touch with the older people in my life.
Oh, lovely.
The really old people, yeah. Talk to them a lot more.
Those are wonderful and unique. Mm-hmm. These are great, Needy. Thank you so much for sharing. I want to share my favorite is from Mary Carr, the author. She just wrote the greatest one. She wrote, I resolved this year to ditch my AirPods when walking. Oh, sugar. Ditch my AirPods when walking, to scroll various feeds less, to listen and love harder, to watch less political news and yet be more activist, to memorize more poetry, and try to see God in all things. That's a pretty
lovely.
That's a pretty nice
Very
one,
nice.
Right? All right. Anything else I need to know about in January, ladies?
Well, I think it's keeping your resolutions in mind, but, you know, I think the exciting thing about being here is being open, as Mickey said, like, to all these new experiences and maybe trying one new thing.
Like decorating shopping cart.
Like she put in a plug. Oh, do we have time for one last caller? All right, we got one last caller, Jen from Westchester. Hi, Jen.
Hi, Allison. Thanks so much for this opportunity. My goal is to reduce my consumption of plastic. I'm single, so I do a lot of takeouts, and I love yogurts, and everything seems to be coming in a plastic container these days. While I do recycle everything, it's really to reduce bringing it into my home, and I'm hoping that more and more people do the same, and also we look at manufacturing to find more biodegradable plastics too in the future, because I really think this is something long term we all need to address. But that is my goal, and I wanted to make it public, so thank you for giving me this forum to tell the world.
All right, Jim, we'll check back with you maybe in a few weeks, see how you're doing.
Yeah, I'd love to let you know how I'm doing. That'd be great. Thanks
excellent.
So much.
Excellent.
Great show.
Thanks for calling.
All right, bye-bye.
Do you know what? Actually, I got a iced coffee coming in this morning, and I picked up a plastic straw, and I put it back. I had that moment. One little thing can make a big difference, right?
Right there.
Do you, Claire, do you have a resolution yet? We gave you 25 minutes.
No, I haven't thought of one yet. I procrastinate on everything. So I feel like if I'm going to make a big change or something, then I need to just start. It's okay. So here it is, like working on that immediately instead of pushing it to January.
How about procrastination? How about that, Claire?
I'll stop. I'll work on that.
Okay. Claire Lampin and Jen Chung from The Gothamist, thanks so much for coming to the studio. Hope to catch up with you guys again soon.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
When we come back, we'll introduce a new series on All of It, a collaboration with the Academy of American Poets and their online digital collection, Poem a Day. Stay with us. All of It will be back after a quick break. Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. A sonnet, 14 lines with a rhyme structure. An elegy, a mournful lament. A limerick, 5 lines, a sly verse. Think AABBA, haikus, couplets that woo, they're all poetry. Once the most popular form of literature, after a 2-decade decline in readership, poetry is making a comeback. According to the NEA, nearly 12% of U.S. adults, that's 28 million people, read poems last year. The number's on par with 2002 reading levels, the year when the National Endowment for the Arts, in conjunction with the census, started to track consumption of poetry. All of It would like to announce that we have a new collaboration with our new friends of the show, the Academy of American Poets. To tell you more, Jennifer Benka is in studio with us. Jen, you've been called America's biggest poetry lobbyist. Is that true?
I'm happy to be called that, yes.
I'm going to give you your official title. Your official title is President and Executive Director of the Academy of American Poets. You oversee poets. .org, National Poetry Month, a poem a day, an original series that sends, you guessed it, a poem each and every day, weekday, to your inbox. The poems reach 500,000 readers when they wake up in the morning. We're so glad to have you.
Thank you, Allison. I'm so happy to be here.
So how did Poem a Day start up?
Poem a Day launched in 2006 as a special project during National Poetry Month, which takes place every April and is an occasion that our organization founded in 1996 to spotlight the importance of poetry in our culture. We relaunched the series in 2012 as the first place of publication for a new poem by one of today's talented poets every day during the week. On the weekends, we feature classic poems largely from the public domain.
So why do you think people are reading more poetry now? It's just interesting.
It's fascinating, and we're thrilled to see the increase and happy to have the National Endowment for the Arts validate what we've been seeing over the past several years, which is an incredible rise in readership. I think there are many reasons why people are coming to poems and poetry with such force and such demand. One, it's the perfect art form for the digital age. Poems, text-based, compact, highly shareable on social media. And if you dip in Twitter or Instagram, you'll see lots of people sharing images of poems, inspirational lines from poems. So definitely the fact that we're in a digital age, a social media age, poetry is the perfect art form for that time. But I have to say, we've also been seeing another trend over the past couple of years, and that's readers seeking out work that speaks to current events. In the past few years, poems on poets.org, like Still I Rise by Maya Angelou, very inspirational poem speaking to the times that we're living in, has been read millions of times. I checked this morning, and last year, Still I Rise was read more than 700,000 times in 2018 alone.
That's so interesting. And I also have to imagine, as our definition of who is a poet and who is a poet of note or of worth, whatever you want to say that means, has expanded to for people of color and women and gender identification. And
absolutely. And in fact, the study that the NEA did demonstrated that the largest growth in readership for poems is young people and young people of color especially. I think over the past 20 years, we've seen an incredible rise in poetry slam, poets taking to social media, sharing their work on YouTube, performance poetry. And I suspect that that growth in readership among young people isn't just young people flocking to the classics. I think that they're checking each other out on YouTube. They're reading each other's work. They're celebrating each other's work. All to say, I think that contemporary poetry in the United States is really in a heyday.
So can you explain to our listeners how the Poems a Day work? You have various curators every month. Explain the structure, please.
Sure. So this is our second year engaging 12 award-winning poets from across the United States who each curate a month of poems. We've done that so that as we seek to reflect contemporary American poetry today and the breadth of thousands of poets writing work, that we have more input, more voices on the mic, so to speak, more people at the table. And we're excited, very excited, to have an incredible lineup of poets who will be curating this year, including poets who serve as state and city poets laureate, and our very own poet laureate of the United States, Tracy K. Smith, who will be curating in April, which again is National Poetry Month.
This is interesting. So I heard of states having poet laureates. Cities do as well?
Cities, yes. And in fact, that is a phenomenon that has really taken off since 2001. States had poets laureate before the United States had a federal position. And it's been interesting to see in the past several years the rise in this position, this civic position, at the city level over the past several years.
What is the job of the poet laureate?
They vary. In some cases, the poet, and I'm not speaking about the U.S. poet laureate, who is a consultant to the Library of Congress, but on the state and city level, the position varies. Some are appointed to write occasional poems for important events in the city, a new bridge being opened, for example. Others start city council meetings by sharing a poem. A lot of times the role, which is typically honorific, is to celebrate the art form at the local level by visiting schools, encouraging youth to engage with the art form, try their own hand at writing poems. So it really depends.
We're speaking with Jennifer Benka. She is president and executive director of the Academy of American Poets. Well, we're very excited to work with you over the course of the next year. So the idea is that if I sign up, which I did, you get a poem a day.
Right.
Is it all contemporary poetry?
Through Friday
requirements?
The poems are by contemporary poets. And again, these are poems that have never appeared anywhere else. Poem a Day is the first place of publication for 260 poems. On the weekends, we're featuring historic poems. So the contemporary poems are engaged in a conversation across the 7 days with their predecessors.
Well, let's listen to the first poem of 2019.
Yeah.
Let's listen to it, and you can tell me a little bit maybe more about the poet on the other side.
Hi, this is Manuel Arturo Abreu, and I'm reading a poem called Sound Has Ears. In the mercy of the more hollow sister, a serene fog of moons sprinkled with plum, the vexed taint of Quasimodo is patient. Her tongue leaps from her mouth like a tombstone, 3 times, smooth as ash. Her favorite word is apothecary, the bliss in me like the interior of a melting fear, as she moves time with an even glance, the boorish anvil of rain, as she leads me into a gully, farther into the hollow sister's carny lungs, teaching me to hear in silence as hearts do.
That is such a beautiful poem. Poem Sound Has Ears. Why was that the first one?
Well, I'm happy to say that we've launched 2019 with the poet T.C. Tolbert curating the month of January. T.C. lives in Tucson, Arizona, is a trans poet who is serving as the poet laureate of Tucson, Arizona. And I think that across the month, we'll have an opportunity to hear from many trans poets, genderqueer poets that T.C. has identified and wanted to share work by, which is one of the exciting aspects, I think, of Poem a Day is an opportunity to really learn about the range of poets writing today. And again, the reason why we're working with guest curators is so that voices we here in New York in our office would never think of bringing into the series to share with our readers. So we're really happy to have that special opportunity.
And they will be with us later in the month. Hope is coming in.
Yes.
There's a poem today that they picked. It's called Plan Upon Arrival by Soretta Morgan. Can I put you on the spot and get you to share it?
Sure. I'd love to. You want me to read it?
Sure.
Oh, I'd love to. And hopefully Soretta won't mind. This is actually an excerpt from a book project that Soretta is doing of the same title, Plan Upon Arrival. 7. Letters arrived in intervals. As with everything else, one might not, regardless of whether there'd been a response. We prepared at all times, bent over. We dreamed things would be different. Every time the door opened, we each smiled in a way to make clear we'd never seen our own face. 8. An appendix washed up, pages, current, smoothed, leaning funny. We stood and watched the skin stretched and sewn, the so-called imaginary, so-called interior, so-called paradoxical private sphere. 13. Dailiness was the anxiety through which we waited. Buttons undone like clearance. Not what we wanted, but what we didn't know we had to have. Private acts to attempt in public. Productive relationships to sites of violence. Lace fronts. A dollar to run to the store. 19. However useful, the language was degrading. Incompatible and lacked necessary verbs. The ability to compress, overflow, and alter the landscape through a slow, swollen hum. To smell strongly in the morning, at the grocery, or over the phone. 24. There were moments we were incapable of decision, an opening through which to register an image pungent through its own material law, a body pulled inward, door unlocked, irresponsible to. That this moment would return us, that this and only this would be the day.
Jennifer, I know you believe that poetry promotes empathy. How?
That's an excellent question, and I truly do. I think that reading poems is an opportunity to engage with an idea from another person and to learn about their lives in the most intimate way. Where journalism strives toward objectivity, poetry strives toward subjectivity. So in that sense, having an opportunity to engage with Soretta's ideas, her voice, the concepts that she's struggling to put on page, wanting us to contemplate, is an opportunity to get outside of my own life and think about someone else. And I think that that's a necessary and powerful experience for all of us, maybe especially now.
Jennifer Benke is the president and executive director of the Academy of American Poets. We're so excited about this collaboration.
I am too. Thank you so much.
It's going to be great, and I'm going to make you sit through something.
Okay.
As we mentioned before, we're going to be speaking with some of the guest editors of Poem a Day for our recurring poetry series. Now, a producer thought reading poetry was so lovely and fun that she wanted to try writing a limerick. So I'm going to read it because she did this.
Excellent.
It's called Olivet Attempts a Limerick. On Monday through Fridays at noon, we talk culture here to the moon. When Olivet airs, WNYC blares. Prepare for more poetry soon.
Fabulous.
Also, we want to do a little sidebar here. The world got a nice surprise at midnight on New Year's Eve. Culture is affected. Officially, it's okay to publish at length Robert Frost poems, Winston Churchill's The World Crisis. You can see more Charlie Chaplin, hear other works from other United States people who have been published in 1923, it was the end of this specific public domain law. Jennifer Jenkins, director of Duke Law School Center for the Study of the Public Domain, says the public domain has been frozen in time for 20 years, and we're reaching the 20-year thaw. There's going to be all this great culture out there for people to use and to enjoy and to share. So we will be publishing Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening by Robert Frost on our website, because now we can. All of it will be back after a quick break with the filmmakers behind a new documentary called The Last Resort. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thanks for listening. The documentary The Last Resort is perfectly named. It looks at a unique period in Floridian history in the 1970s when Miami South Beach was home to the largest cluster of Jewish retirees in all of America, many of whom were New Yorkers looking for more temperate climates. Let's take a listen to a piece from The Last Resort.
Imagine South Beach today, but instead of seeing everybody between 18 and 28, think of everybody between like 81 and 82.
Miami, I feel like being in heaven.
It was a colorful town, full of colorful people.
This is beautiful, and this is special, and this is short-lived.
What do you do for fun?
Nothing, just sit on the porch.
There were two photographers who recognized that this was an important moment in South Beach history, Andy Sweet and Gary Monroe. The pair started the Miami Beach Photography Project. The project documented the lives of the retirees, many of whom were Holocaust survivors. The project has black and white stills as well as unposed, vibrant color images. Now, the film looks at how their lives intersected with their subjects. IndieWire says of the film, Miami's post-World War II Jewish population shines in spirited documentary, part mystery, part anthropological study. A new film illuminates the lost legacy of a queer photographer. Tomorrow is the last day that you can catch The Last Resort at the Quad Cinemas in Greenwich Village. We're so happy to have the film's directors Kareem Tabash and Dennis Scholl joining us. Hi.
Hi there.
Hey, Allison.
So, Dennis, Miami Beach for a time earned the nickname Little Jerusalem. Why was Miami Beach? Why South Beach?
Well, it's a really interesting moment because 75% of the population was Jewish on South Beach, and something like 75% of the population was also over 65. So it was a moment where New Yorkers in particular, New Jersey, New Yorkers, people that were school teachers, firemen, policemen, government workers, found a place in the sunshine where they could come down and live on their pensions. And the sun was out every day and the ocean was right outside your front door. So it was a real interesting moment for Miami Beach.
So Kareem, this film is about that history, but it's also about these two photographers who realized they wanted to document this moment, Andy Sweet and Gary Monroe. How did you first hear about Andy Sweet and Gary Monroe?
The Washington Post did an article a few years ago discovering Andy Sweet's work, and I came across it, and just like anyone else who sees it, immediately fell in love. And then the Miami New Times, which is a sister publication of the Village Voice, did a more in-depth article describing Andy and Gary's work and Andy's life and unfortunate and untimely death. And we knew that this was just a really kind of special story to share. Dennis and I had been longtime friends and looking for an opportunity to collaborate. And we actually both came to this story separately. And over dinner, talking about what we wanted to do next, said, you know, there's this great story about these photographers in South Beach in the 70s, and decided that that was going to be our collaboration. And then the product of that is The Last Resort.
So, Dennis, what was it about this time that made it rich for a photographer?
Well, it was a very, very specific subculture. And the things you always need as a photographer are a really great idea and access. And Andy and Gary were nice Jewish boys that had grown up on Miami Beach. And of course, you know, anybody that's listening knows that everybody's nana wound up on South Beach at one point or another. And so they had access to this community. This community trusted them. They spent lots of time with people in the community. they and their cameras became just an everyday occurrence for the you know, the people that were living on South Beach. And so they both knew that they had kind of found something that was very special, very unique, wasn't going to last forever, and they had this extraordinary access because the community trusted them. And of course, the results are just beautiful.
What did Miami Beach look like at that time?
You know, it's almost hard to imagine it in relation to what it is today. South Beach today is glitz and glamour and, you know, 24-hour nightlife and beautiful, scantily clad bodies. There were scantily clad bodies then, too, with maybe a 50-year age difference, though. it was a thriving community, you know. There's been a new book that came out of Andy Sweet's work called Shtetl in the Sun by Letter 16 Press. And that's such a great expression because it was a Jewish community. It was a place where people came and found camaraderie, people with a shared experience. You know, there was Yiddish theater and radio and newspapers. Some of the places that are now nightclubs were then showing, you know, Russian cinema. And it's so vastly different than what it is today. Thankfully, really, the thread that has connected present-day South Beach to that era is a beautiful Art Deco architecture that was preserved thanks to the efforts of the Miami Design Preservation League and activists like Barbara Bear Kapitman. So when you visit the space today, though, the people who are living and thriving and enjoying South Beach are very, very different. You still see the bones thanks to this beautiful architecture and the history that it carries. And one of that history is this rich, wonderful community of Jewish retirees.
We're talking to Karim Tabesh and Dennis Scholl about their film, The Last Resort, which is at the Quad Cinema. You can catch it tonight. There's also the story of these two photographers, of their lives, how they intersected. I don't want to use the word rivalry because that's not really the right word. They were friends and they coexisted, but they really had a very different artistic points of view. So Dennis, can you describe Andy's photos a little bit, and then can you describe Gary's photos?
Well, when asked what his color should be like, Andy said, think beach ball. And so that was his goal in shooting. He wanted to make these vibrant, quick shots that were very, very, almost like candy. And then Gary, on the other hand, Gary was a very, and remains actually, I met Andy a couple times and I still know Gary as a friend. And Gary was a very traditional photographer. He was a black and white photographer, thinking a lot about framing, thinking a lot about how to set up a shot, thinking. Gary was, very, very in a scholarly mode, and Andy was very spontaneous. And they both work beautifully. Both of the photographs' styles work beautifully.
So, Karim, you have Andy's style, which is sort of fantastic and colorful and playful, and you have Gary's style, which is a little bit more like Dorothea Lange, kind of serious and focused. When you think about what that time was like that we're talking about, which the film focuses on, does either photographer capture it more realistically?
You know, I think that it's more about the fact that the work together captures a full encompassing of what the community was like. Andy's vibrant, saturated color work really does a wonderful job of capturing the joy that people were experiencing in this kind of, you know, Eden by the sea. And Gary's work, through the formality of his black and white approach, really captured some of the more serious components to it, because as with everything, you know, aging can be joyful and towards the end of your life, it might not be always as such. And so I think that really for me, and I hope for many people when you watch the film, what you'll see is not only how beautiful the work is of each individual artist what standing on its own, but when you look at it together, how wonderfully it captures this community. And it really is one of the best visual histories, I think, of a community that I've ever come across, precisely so because it's such different styles that complement one another.
It's really great. In the film, you see a lot of photos of parties and people having a great time and also sharing their history. But at some point, the retirement community begins to decline. How does this show up in the photographer's work?
Well, I think what Kareem was mentioning is that I think Gary's work, with its very stark portrayal of aging, really shows you what happened to the community. It became a place where landlords weren't necessarily taking care of their buildings. The tenants there, the retirees, had fixed pensions and so weren't able to pay significant rent increases. And the city began to kind of get involved too, and they were looking for something new, something different, and they weren't so anxious to continue to be the shtetl in the sun. There were people starting to pay attention to South Beach at that time. And so you see in Gary's photos in particular the kind of loneliness of your friends dying around you, mm-hmm. and people whose families stopped visiting them, and those kind of moments, which we all know about. And of course, when we do the screenings, and the film is going to travel to a number of other cities via our great indie distributor, Kino Lorber, when we do the screenings, I always ask how many people here had somebody's in their family on South Beach. I got to tell you, about half the audience raises their hand every time.
I'm sure, yeah.
So this is a story that really resonates with people on a very personal level. It's not just a historical story to them, or it's not just an anthropology story. It's really a story that everybody knows.
As we learn about this community declining, we also see the decline of Andy. In the film, it suggests that he has developed a drug problem. His family's concerned about him. And as we mentioned briefly, that Andy died young. He's 28 years old. Kareem, you share the story of how Andy died?
Yeah. Andy, we really say that Andy was a victim of a changing time in a changing city. And while the details of what led to that are still in question, and we certainly think that drugs played a part of it, in October of 1982, Andy was stabbed to death in his apartment. And it was obviously a shock for the family, but also a shock for the community, because he was so alive and he was so vibrant, just like his photographs. And for many people, it was indicative of the changing time that everyone was living in, how this kind of sleepy little seaside city was really kind of encountering, the brutality that the 80s would bring, and the wave of crime that for a large part really kind of was all too commonplace in Miami.
And at one point, I don't want to give too much away, but at what point was there a resurgence in interest about Andy and his work?
Well, the thing that happened is that Andy's work was lost. All of mm-hmm. his negatives were lost. And Andy's sister's partner was working in a family storage unit one day, and he suddenly found all these test prints. Now, test prints aren't really the kind of photographs that you would use to show your work at its best, but this happened 20 years later, and when they were found 20 years later, Photoshop had really evolved enough so that Stan, who's in the film, could go back and take these test prints and turn them into really beautiful, super saturated, gorgeous images. So the excitement about the work started happening, maybe 7 or 8 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, something like that. And of course, Andy's sister began to put them on Facebook, and their response was extraordinary. I mean, people went crazy for the work, and that's what generated these things like the Washington Post and the New Times and the book that we were talking about. So there's a full-fledged renaissance going on now about Andy's work, and it's a wonderful thing to watch. And the film is really just a way of paying homage to not only a community that was lost, but also that artwork that we thought was lost and has since been found. It's a great, great time right now for Andy's work.
And
we really hope that what our film is able to do is honor the beauty and of the images, but also honor this community and this time and place in our city. Miami's a very different place, and it's changed a great deal. But you know, those who come before us really inform who we are. And I think it's about due that we are able to honor both the community and the artists. And our hope is that the film will, you know, warm your heart, but also teach you a little bit about the folks that made this city such an interesting place.
And if folks want to take a look at some of these photos, I know we're going to put a couple on our Instagram. Where's a good place to go?
Well, you can see the lastresortmovie.com, and we from there link to Andy and Gary's site, and you can see some more of his work. Shtetl in the Sun, the book we described, is out and available. And The Last Resort is expanding to cities throughout the U.S., and we hope it'll return to New York for a later run. Make sure to catch it at the Quad and really enjoy the work and the history and our film.
And that is tonight at the Quad, the last night, but it'll probably come back around, I have a feeling. Directors Karim Tabash and Dennis Scholl, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Allison.
You've been listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart, and we will be right back after the news.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.